So, Tyler, I hear that this past week you had a really good ethics consult. What was it about?
Yeah, so super interesting question. And it's not a question that's entirely unique, but I think one thing that's really interesting about bioethics, and I think that's maybe one of your previous coworkers, Tom Tomlinson, said this, that bioethics is interesting because the issues are cyclical, meaning that they come around again and again and again. And usually it's technology that drives some of these re-examinations of previous questions. So, for example, the technology around gene editing, for example, is always changing and always getting more precise and advanced. And so the papers that were all written, or the books that were written in the late 90s about gene editing, are being rediscovered or used sometimes to apply to more contemporary iterations of the same problem. Anyway, so the question was about pacemakers. So, an implantable device that helps regulate heartbeat. And the question was about whether or not turning off the pacemaker, either the patient requesting it, which is really unusual, or in the situation where a family is making or a surrogate is making decisions, is it under what circumstances is it okay for a pacemaker to be terminated, to be shut off? And part of the concern that was raised in this specific question and also in the literature is that not more like killing the patient directly than withdrawing a patient from a ventilator, for example? And how do we compare these different technologies that perpetuate somebody's life in a way that is different or the same? And so the question came from a cardiologist or somebody working in the cardiology with the cardiology service. And so a patient was very ill and was unlikely to was there's no reasonable expectation that the patient was going to recover, and actually the pacemaker continuing to fire, and the way it was described is that the patient basically had no underlying heart rate or heartbeat. And so all of the cardiac function was being stimulated by the pacemaker. And so by turning it off, they were basically turning off the all cardiac function, which feels a lot different than, withdrawing a ventilator, and maybe the patient breathes, maybe they don't, maybe they breathe for a little bit and then pass away peacefully. So that's the question.
Interesting. I mean, my first reaction to it is that it sounds exactly like the case of withdrawing a ventilator because you need to breathe. If you don't breathe, you die. And if we take out the means of breathing, we do expect you to die. I mean, there are cases in which somebody kind of is breathing over the vent and we might anticipate that they could breathe a bit longer. Or sometimes it's apparently a surprise, like we didn't think they would continue to breathe, but they do. But the expectation when you withdraw a ventilator is, in end-of-life cases, is that they won't breathe. And so then that will lead to their death. And that could take minutes or it could take hours. Sometimes it can take a Well, I probably not more than a few hours. You can tell me if you've had cases. If they're not breathing at all,
Well,
right? It's not gonna. But if they do continue to
right.
breathe, it could take longer. But a pacemaker, we can predict that it is keeping cardiac function going and that turning it off would, your heart would totally stop. Maybe there are cases in which, like the vent, we didn't expect the heart to keep beating, but it could, and we don't for sure know, but that we do expect it to lead to death. So I guess I'm not sure how they're different. They sound the same to me. So what is the thinking about them being different?
And that's really where the so there's a couple of reasons why they maybe they're not actually different, but they feel different, particularly to the person who's turning them off. And one of
Okay.
them is the immediacy of the patient's death, if there's no underlying cardiac function, right? And in this situation, they were pretty confident of that. But the cardiologist said, it feels different when I flip the switch or do whatever, and they immediately flatline. Like, that feels like I am killing that patient. And so that's what, so the immediacy or the lack of uncertainty. So in some way, that uncertainty provides a little bit of comfort, or at least some distance from the action of withdrawing or shutting off and the actual patient's demise. The other question that gets raised sometimes, particularly in the literature, is in what way is a pacemaker different than an implanted organ or a transplanted organ? Mm. At what point does something implanted into your body that is necessary for your biological function, when does it become part of you? So for example, we don't, you know, turn off or terminate or, you know, shut down in any way implanted organs, transplanted organs. So somebody's kidney, we're not going around turning that off. But so I mean, there's definitely some differences, but I think it raises some interesting concerns, particularly for people who haven't thought about, who don't deal with the withdrawal or withholding of life-sustaining treatment as commonly as it is done in like an ICU setting. So a pulmonologist, an ICU pulmonologist, is pretty experienced in withdrawing or withholding a ventilator and seeing how that process plays out. It's less common, I think, for a cardiologist to be asked to shut off a pacemaker.
I'm sure that's true, right? We do terminal extubations quite frequently. And it might just be that the cardiologist is raising this because they're not doing that sort of thing. They're not taking away treatments that lead to death very often at all. And so it feels different to them. They haven't gotten used to it. I mean, for better or worse, they're just not as experienced with that. But you're right about the immediacy. That feels very immediate. And so that can feel pretty weird. It can feel like killing, even if we might agree ethically it's not. I just make the case, I don't think it's ethically killing. I don't think it's equivalent to killing. You are actively doing something that causally is associated with the death, but we try to justify these kind of terminal withdrawals of treatment by saying it's the technology that was keeping them alive, and we're merely withdrawing the treatment. The question, though, about the organs is so interesting because, of course, we would never equate like a human organ transplant with a medical technology that we could just deactivate. And in some ways, that's maybe merely because it's not something we can easily deactivate. You'd have to like go in surgically and remove an organ, which is pretty different than like waving a magnet over a pacemaker. Isn't that how you deactivate it?
I think that's generally, it's some sort of external, a wand or a magnet or something like that, that is programmed to shut it off. Yeah. So, and that's, I mean, there's that movie from, I don't know, maybe the mid 2000s called Repo Men. Did you ever see that movie?
I've never seen it, but I know the movie. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the idea, you know, just a little bit of background, the movie, it follows these folks whose job it is to go and reclaim surgically, brutally, transplanted organs if folks who got the organs are unable to maintain their payments. So if they basically default on their payment for the organ transplant procedure, then they go into default, and just like you would have your car repossessed if you don't, you know, pay the loan on it, same thing happens. But so that's kind of the idea. But if we start thinking about pacemakers and organs as being different, which I, you know, obviously that is the case, but there are other things that we do medically that maybe are a little bit more in between. Like, for example, you and I have talked a lot about deep brain stimulation. So deep brain stimulation is where you go in and put, you know, very precise electrodes and wires and such, and even like a battery pack sometimes implanted. And at what point, if ever, does that device become so integrated into the individual that it becomes part of them, such that you can't remove it, right?
Yeah. Well, and sometimes deep brain stimulation is called like a brain pacemaker. So because it's firing in ways that maybe more like a defibrillator would, but, or maybe more like a pacemaker. I actually think it's a better analogy to a pacemaker. I haven't heard people claiming at this point, and maybe just because it's pretty new, that it's so integrated into your body that it could never be switched off. But that might be the case one day. I mean, I feel like I talk to people with various disabilities who use prosthetics, who do consider those prosthetics part of their body. Like, it wouldn't be something you could just take away from them. This came up during COVID. I remember when people were very afraid that if they went to the hospital with COVID, their individual ventilators, so people who need kind of breathing machines all the time, that those would be taken away from them and used on other patients as kind of a triage if folks thought that the individual wasn't really benefiting from their own breathing machine, and that really scared people. And the claim was that it's part of my body. It's not something you can just take away from me and give to somebody else. And so there is this kind of fine line between, just because it's a machine doesn't mean it's not part of your body. But it does seem like there's something pretty different with a transplanted organ, like ontologically, than a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. It's hard to kind of pinpoint. Maybe somebody, one of our good philosophy friends, can come up with a schema for us. And it can't be simply as easy as one is like from a human to a human and the other is a machine. Like that won't hold up, I don't think.
Right, because we are, you know, moving towards a reality of transplanting non-human organs into individuals, whether they're xenotransplantation, which means from non-humans into humans, like, you know, pig heart, for example, or pig valves, but also like genetically engineered or, you know, fully mechanical organs being implanted. And so, for example, a total artificial heart that is a medical technology that exists and is available and people receive it. But the process of doing that is you actually, you know, remove the person's diseased heart and put in a fully functional mechanical heart. Like, does that become part of the person to the point that it's you? I don't know. It just gets... it feels very sci-fi sometimes, but also maybe we're just overthinking this.
Well, that's what we do as bioethicists, is we overthink things.
That's true.
And then try to come up with simplistic policies that work for everything.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know where the line is, but so what did you say? Did you say it was permissible to deactivate the pacemaker?
Yeah. So that was the recommendation. Was we talked a lot about the difference between you know, actively killing somebody and what that would look like. And so the clinician who I was talking with was using some terminology inconsistently, or kind of misusing some terminology in unhelpful ways, like physician-assisted suicide, for example. I thought that he was being asked to help an individual commit suicide, which is a completely different type of issue, or that it was euthanasia, you know, some sort of like mercy killing, and that his medical expertise was being co-opted in a way that was inappropriate. And so we kind of talked through all of those issues and those topics. And I think at the end of the day, he was comfortable doing it, but only because there was still a little bit more ambiguity than he let on at the beginning about whether or not the person had an underlying heart rate. So it was
interesting.
So because there was he felt that there was some potential that when he turned off the pacemaker, that it wasn't going to be an immediate flat line, that ambiguity or that uncertainty was comforting for him.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, right? It feels a little less like direct killing.
Yeah.
If you allow sort of the natural process to linger and then happen what feels like more on its own, like it feels less causal if it doesn't immediately happen. And I think, again, ethically, we would say that's not an important difference in theory, but in practice, to the person doing it, it might feel important.
Yeah. And oftentimes we're, as clinical ethicists, put in a position where we are trying to reassure professionals that what they're doing is okay, right? That it's not, you're not actually killing your patient, that here's how you can understand or think through this process or what's going on in order to give them some comfort. But I think I was successfully able to do that in this particular case, but it sent me down a couple of different rabbit holes, and I've been annoying my colleagues with, wait a second, what about this, what about this, what about this, about this issue of pacemakers, which it was kind of 2010 11 12. There was a kind of a rash of papers talking about this, and I don't know, maybe it's time to readdress those questions that were raised.
Well, do you think anything new has come of this question? Like, is there any reason that it needs to be thought about anew other than it's happening still and it's still making people uncomfortable? Or is there something different about pacemakers in the last 10 years that warrants a new investigation?
In my mind, it's not that the pacemaker itself has changed. It's that there are so many other technologies that are either more or less like an implanted pacemaker, like deep brain simulation, for example, that maybe the whatever framework was used to make it make sense 10 or 15 years ago, maybe we need to readdress that, that maybe there are other things or other ways to look at it. But yeah, so that's what I'm obsessed about this week.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, we don't want to let people feel like they're killing their patients, right? And I know that sometimes we'll use this concept of double effect to talk about it, to say, you know, it's not you that's killing the patient, it's their disease that's killing them, right? There's a reason this patient's heart stopped. Actually, the only reason that they're still alive at all is because of this technology, and that might not be what they would have wanted. And so it's not you doing it. Initially when I teach about double effect, my students are often like, that just sounds like a weaselly way to, you know, say what you're doing is actually right when it's actually wrong. But I don't think that's right. I think that there is an important difference between saying, you know, this thing is killing your patient versus you're removing the thing that is, sort of prolonging their death in unreasonable, burdensome ways. And you're allowing the disease, the underlying disease, to be the thing that allows them to die versus, you know, sort of prolonging that with a technology. So I think it is important to have those differences. But at the same time, like you said, a really important job of the clinical ethicist is talking about moral distress. And so insofar as the clinician feels like they're killing someone, that obviously is going to lead to some moral distress if you feel like you're killing your patients, unless you're like a sociopath. Like, most physicians don't want to kill their patients. Or you know, unless it's in some parameters of legally acceptable physician aid in dying. But most are not trying to kill their patients. And so they need to like be able to think through the differences. And that's really important, because otherwise we would be vitalists. Otherwise we'd force all of our patients to remain on all the technology ever to sustain a heartbeat simply because we think everything else is killing. And I hope we would never get to that point. We need to allow patients to die. It's everybody dies. And if, you know, we don't want to keep people in states where it's just a bunch of machines pushing blood through their bodies, that's not how anybody wants to, that's not really living, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think from, if we're focusing just on the pacemaker issue, there's a difference between turning off a pacemaker that is continually firing with somebody who is otherwise clinically dead, right? So, or so far along the pathway towards death that the firing of the pacemaker is actually harming them, causing harm, right? Perpetuating suffering. So that's kind of one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum might be an otherwise healthy individual walks into a cardiologist outpatient clinic and says, you know what, I just go ahead and shut this off. I'm done. Right. So being completely voluntary. Yeah. And being, you know, an obvious case. And man, the more I think about it, the more I you know, so for me, like one of the analogies that we were thinking through with my, you know, my colleagues was what about contact lenses? Like, at what, there's like glasses, there's contact lenses, there's surgeries you can do. Like, at what point does that become, is it because it's so necessary for me to live in the world being able to see well that those contacts are more part of me than they're not part of me? Is it something about being inside my eye, but on the surface of my eyelid or my lens, where glasses and contacts are different in some way, or should we think about them the same, or I don't know.
It's a great, these are great, great philosophy questions, right? Like, what is your body? And it's not as simple as you might think. Like, I think the more I think about these things, I get in the exact same headspace of like, well, what is my body? What is it my body? Like, when I'm pregnant, is that baby my body? Is it not my body? Is my, my contact lens? What if it's a surgically implanted contact lens? Is that my body now? These are great questions. And does it have to be inside me to be my body? Can it be an extension of my body? These are really good questions.
Yeah. So if I do some body modification and have like, you know, piercings or some sort of implants that change the way my face looks, does that become part of me? Does it?
Yeah.
And what about like nanotechnology? It's things that like devices that are so very, very, very small and can like actually go through your circulatory system. Are those foreign? Are they part of you? Does it depend on whether there's an immuno reaction to it? I don't know.
And if they're not part of you, then what about our whole microbiome? Like more of our cells are not human than are human. And so if we were to say like nanotechnology is not part of us, then how do we account for all the non-human stuff that's already inside of our bodies?
Yeah. There is no person, Devin. We are not. So anyway, so that's what I'm obsessed about this week.
It's a good one. Pacemakers. It's a good one. Let us know what you think. What is our body? I bet the listeners out there know. They can give us a good definition. What's part of our body? What's not? What's a machine?